I'd like to reflect a bit on thoughts and emotions. Now, these are, and I guess the title of this would be Thoughts and Emotions Revisited, because we talk about thoughts and emotions quite a lot and read quite a lot about them. It's central to our practice, our meditation practice. So most mindfulness-based meditations, as opposed to visualizations or guided meditations, emphasize working with thoughts and emotions. That's a key, you know, focus there. And we're taught to practice moment-by-moment awareness of what's going on in our minds, what's going on in our bodies, what is going on, whatever we're receiving from the outside well. And it suggested that we practice labeling, giving names to the thoughts and emotions that are coming up. It has occurred to me recently that we're actually dealing with two different states. They may be related, thoughts and emotions. They often are related. Certainly emotions are related, thoughts to thoughts. And I've been thinking that it can be useful to acknowledge that the difference between thoughts and emotions and maybe deal with them in slightly different ways. And I think it brought me back to some of Jocko Beck's writings, particularly The Cocoon of Pain, which we read an excerpt of. That's actually from it's a small part of a section of a chapter in one of the books of her collections. Maybe it's nothing special, I think. So there are three or four books of her talks, one of which was produced by her daughter posthumously a couple of years ago. This is an earlier one, though. So first question, what are thoughts? This, of course, led me into a labyrinth of different academic disciplines, and I sort of gave up. You know, I can't. There are lots of debates. It's very tricky territory, depending on what analytical approach someone has. So psychology, philosophy, physiology, engineering. There's a little blog on the MIT website by engineers. What is thought? So there are various ways of looking at thoughts, and I'm not going to be able to resolve that, obviously. A fairly general definition runs something like this, meant that thoughts are mental cognitions, our ideas, opinions, and beliefs about ourselves and the world around us. And they are generally under conscious control, in this one definition. So cognitions that are under our control. But there are different ways of thinking, of course, and different people probably have. I know my own. I tend to think in words, which is fairly common. People can also think, I think, in terms of images. And there's some very interesting twists with people who think in colors. So again, there are various ways of approaching thinking. Where is thinking located? For me, I don't know if it's just conditioning or so. I feel it I can feel my thinking in the head, if that makes sense. Now, what about emotions? Now, the word emotion etymologically is related to moving, stirring, agitation. So it seems to have something different. We're not just talking about cognition here. One definition, again, is felt mental states that arise from the mind's conscious interpretation of bodily sensations that occur automatically and unconsciously. So we're looking at what's happening in the body, and we don't have the same control that we might have, that we can exert over thoughts. That seems to be a cardinal difference. Thoughts are said to differ according in different cultures, but emotions are supposed to be generally shared across cultures. So something like sadness or anger or something like that, all cultures have those. It might be different thoughts that trigger those kinds of things, but those very basic emotions are cross-cultural, are universal, I guess. There's a slight complication, which I can't iron out, in that in popular literature, if not scientific literature, there is a distinction between feelings and emotions. that's unclear, and it seems to, again, I don't know if there's a consensus of that. And I find that even in Joko's writings, there's a bit of a conflation of those two. In that same chapter, she talks about feelings are simply thoughts plus bodily sensations. I guess that I would suggest I would use the word emotions there, but again, it's not for me to say. So we'll use feelings and emotions to be the same, even though in a lot of literature there are distinctions, but they're not always consistent. Look, I speak as an amateur, not as a scholar of thoughts and emotions. So this takes us back to labeling, or at least in my own practice. Now, we know thoughts are quite changeable. They crop up, even though we may have some control of them. They might start of their own. The Buddhist literature, of course, talks about the monkey mind, monkeys climbing from limb to limb on a tree, and a term that's often used, particularly in mindfulness practice, is that it's okay, we can't control thoughts, are made to do, our minds are made to be thinking rapidly. That's probably what protects us from predators and dinosaurs and other nasty things. But eventually we may fall awake to the fact that we have been thinking. And at that point, it's maybe possible to give a label to the kind of thought that we're having. The suggestion has always been to separate the thinker from the thought. So instead of I am having a thought about tomorrow's meeting, just a label which says thinking, planning, something like that, without the I. But there's still a bit of a problem, I think, between the observer and the thought, that when we're labeling, we are actually, we're both observing our mind and having something happen, you know, a thought happen in that. You know, people can identify general patterns by paying attention to their thoughts. I think my favorite one very, very clearly is planning. I want to plan ahead. I want to make sure that and I think as I was just sitting meditating before, that's actually related to a fear that I can, I'll come back to a fear. And the fear is what Joko would say, of failing, of not being good enough. So if I plan everything, you know, then I'll be assured of being okay. And everybody will think, you know, I'm doing a good job. But underneath that is a fear that I'm not doing a good job, of course. So thoughts may disappear or change relatively rapidly, though sometimes rumination occurs when they over and over and over have the same thought. Emotions, now, as I mentioned before, because of its etymology, are something that is felt in the body. And I know my negative thoughts, there are two locales. The primary one is sort of somewhere in here. It's almost like Dantian in Tai Chi, somewhere around the navel or in the stomach, occasionally in the throat. And that may have to be with speaking or having to do, I'm not sure why that is, but those seem to be my primary locations of negative emotions. And it may be difficult to separate, that thoughts may come along with those emotions. But the distinction, it seems to me, is that the emotion is a bodily sensation. You know, we can add a thought to that. Now, one of Joko's great contributions to Western Zen is her attention to emotional pain. So Zen has been traditionally very good about physical pain, maybe almost obsessive about that sort of samurai, you know, tough it out kind of pain. Joko doesn't deny the pain at all, and we still, you know, acknowledges that we do sit with pain, and to a certain extent that can be helpful. When it exceeds a certain point, it is no longer helpful and can be quite destructive to people. But she emphasizes emotional pain and writes at great length, or that talks at great length and about it. Two of the key concepts are A Cocoon of Pain, which we read an excerpt of before, and The Icy Couch, which is something that sort of sends shivers down my spine. I don't know. It's a very, very vivid image to me. I don't know. So she starts, she's got quite a theory about this, which you may or may not want to embrace, that basically from childhood, we have a, what she calls a core belief. And that core belief is that we're not good enough. As a child, we have to rely on others a whole lot. There's so much we can't do. We're not good enough to do what adults do, in a sense, and we have to rely. And that's just a normal part of being a child. Joko suggests that we carry that not good enough with us our whole life. And then we develop strategies of dealing with it to make us feel that we can't cope. And that shows up in the cocoon of pain. And the image, which isn't clear from the excerpt there of the cocoon, is that she calls it the worm or the caterpillar, you know, who starts out, she uses the term worm as something rather ugly and turns into a beautiful butterfly. So that's her image about what we can do with our pain. But we spend a lot of time in that cocoon, and maybe, you know, we'll emerge at some point through our practice as a butterfly. So that's the image of the cocoon. The other one is this icy couch. Now, I don't know if anyone has tried this. She says that the most influential teacher she's had is a French psychiatrist named Hubert Benoit, who wrote a book. I find it just about impenetrable. She remarks in the cocoon, for one thing, each sentence is a paragraph. So I don't know if it's a question of translation or, you know, everything. But the distinguishing characteristic of Benoit was at some point he had some sort of illness that completely paralyzed him. He couldn't move. So all he could do was lie there. And out of that came this image of the icy couch that was all he could do at that point. Okay, so all he could do, Joko writes or speaks, was just lie there. And that is on this hard couch, immobile and cold. What Benoit is saying is that we rest at peace with our pain. This repose is the gateless, or when we rest with peace with our pain, this repose is the gateless gate, and it's the last place we want to be. It's not pleasant, and our whole strategic drive is for pleasantness. No, we want someone to comfort us, save us, give us peace. Our ceaseless thinking, planning, and plotting are always about this, pretty much what we were reading this morning. And she goes on to say, it's often helped me in difficult times to think of that cold, immobile couch, and instead of fighting and struggling, just be willing to rest on it. Over time, we find the couch is the only place that is peaceful, the source of clear action. This is tough stuff. She's a pretty tough woman, I think. And she remarks that this all sounds forbidding. I sort of nod in agreement, it certainly does. But she also observes, life is a series of endless disappointments, and it's wonderful just because it doesn't give us what we want. So there's nothing in life but opportunity. So in conclusion, as we say in our own vows, that dharmas or dharma gates are countless, I vow to wake to them. So opportunities all the time to practice. That's what life is about. And we get disappointed over and over and over again. Sticking with that disappointment, feeling it in the body, may be able to help us emerge as a butterfly. At least that's a very aesthetic goal. So in a sense, what I'm thinking now is that we label thoughts and we are with pain, emotional pain. The two go hand in hand, but they are somewhat different, and the emotions seem to me, I experience as more powerful. I feel them in my body. They don't readily go away. can I find rest on the icy couch of emotional distress?